LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hello, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to First Thursday, the podcast, monthly podcast for the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Acheson, and I will take you through a review of the last 30 days in terms of significant developments in public safety labor issues. We're coming out of what I think of as normally the summer doldrums. You tend not to see nearly as many court decisions coming out from federal courts or state courts in July and August than you do in other times of the year. As such, what we have for you this month, I think, is more of a potpourri than we normally would. Usually for these first Thursdays, we'll try to come up with a theme or two or three that knits together some of the important cases and other materials that have been decided. Today, think of it more as a bit of a smorgasbord. Some very important elements to the smorgasbord, but still a little bit less thematic than normal. Where do we start? Let's start with the Department of Labor, which in early August of 2013 issued what's called a fact sheet. If you want to be specific, fact sheet number 28F. And this is a fact sheet that one could argue substantially rewrites a portion of the Family and Medical Leave Act. It's actually fairly subtle. The fact sheet talks about who's eligible under the FMLA for leave to care for either a spouse or a child. And on page 2 of this fact sheet, in relatively small type, you see the definition of the word spouse, and this is what's new. So under the FMLA, I think this is old hat for everybody, employees are eligible for up to 12 weeks of leave for a qualifying FMLA purpose, and one of them is to care for a spouse who has a serious health condition. Here's the new definition. Spouse means a husband or wife as defined or recognized under state law for purposes of marriage in the state where the employee resides, including common law marriage and same-sex marriage. This is the first time that the Department of Labor has ever construed, or to my knowledge, a court, ever construed the FMLA as granting spousal benefits to same-sex couples. It's a very, very significant development. It's probably predictable in light of the Supreme Court's decisions on gay rights in June, particularly the case known as Windsor. But nonetheless, to see something this quickly come out from the Department of Labor is really quite striking. This goes along with a development we saw earlier this year, where the Department of Labor redefined who is a parent for purposes of FMLA leave. And the new definition, which is also in this fact sheet 28F, the new definition says that parent means a biological, adoptive, step or foster father or mother, now here it comes, or any other individual who stood in loco parentis to the employee when the employee was a child. What does that mean, in loco parentis? It's a Latin phrase, and it means in the place of a parent. So in other words, the Department of Labor was telling us much earlier than when this fact sheet was released in August, was telling us that for FMLA purposes, you didn't need to be a biological or adoptive or step-parent in order to be covered by the FMLA for purposes of parental leave, that instead, if you were in a parental relationship to the child, presumably including same-sex couple parental relationships, you would be covered for the purposes of the FMLA. No doubt this interpretation by the Department of Labor will be challenged. My guess is it's probably within the purview of the Department of Labor to define spouse and certainly child in this fashion, and that fact sheet 28F will be upheld. While we're under the heading, the general heading of discrimination laws, let's move for a moment over to Title VII, because we've had a pretty big development in the ongoing Connecticut case concerning minimum physical fitness standards for the job. And to reset this for you, the Department of Corrections in Connecticut, the State Department of Corrections, for many years used what you can describe as age and gender graded tests to determine whether or not someone could do all of the physical requirements of being a corrections officer. These age and gender graded tests have different standards for men and women and different standards depending upon how old you are. So if you're in the age 40 to 50 bracket and you are a woman, that is the most lax standard. If you're in the age 20 to 30 bracket and you are a man, that's the toughest standard. A federal court many years ago, about 3 years ago now, held those standards illegal, held that they violated Title VII. Why? Well, all physical fitness standards discriminate. I mean, that's the nature of a physical fitness standard, right? You are trying to get the most physically fit people for a job, and so it's going to discriminate against those who can't meet those standards. And because of the way we are built, they tend to discriminate against women. There are even some suggestions that physical fitness standards, some of them, discriminate against certain racial groups, but that's not as strong. There's no question. If you use the same physical fitness standard, it is going to discriminate against women. What that means is that a physical fitness standard is going to have to meet the tests for Title VII. And what are the tests for Title VII? It means the standard is going to have to be job-related and consistent with business necessity. Those are separate tests. They involve different things. Job-related means, do the standards actually predict performance of essential functions of the job? Consistent with business necessity means there aren't any other tests out there that will test for those same essential standards for the job. In other words, you got to have this test. There's just simply no substitute. Well, age and gender graded tests, like the Department of Corrections had used for many years, have long been suspect on both of those counts. There's never been a strong showing that those age and gender graded tests are substantially related to the performance of a firefighter's job, police officer's job, corrections officer's job. So there's a lot of suspicion as to whether or not they're job related. But certainly in terms of business necessity, they almost by definition fail. And the reason that by definition they fail is they can't meet that necessity test. Think about it for a moment. If you are saying to a 48-year-old woman, look, if you run a mile and a half in 18 minutes, you can be a corrections officer, you can do the essential functions of the job. How can you have any tougher standard that is consistent with business necessity? By definition, you can't, right? You are saying to that 48-year-old woman, you can do all the essential functions of the job. Why then can you have a tougher standard for a 23-year-old woman or a 23-year-old male? And that's what the court in this Connecticut case found, is that these age and gender graded tests do not meet the business necessity standard. The development that we've seen in this case is that the Department of Corrections has decided to resolve the case by a settlement. And the settlement is going to involve paying $3 million to a group of applicants who claimed that they were discriminated against on the grounds that they were forced to run a mile and a half in about 15 minutes. And also, the Department of Corrections is going to continue what it has done. It started something after the litigation started, and that is it dropped the mile and a half run. on the grounds it couldn't really show that a mile and a half run was job related for a corrections officer. And instead, the Department of Corrections is using a 300 meter run. This is just one of several cases that have called into question these age and gender graded tests, and also remind everybody, I think, that if you're going to have physical fitness tests for the job, you need to not just validate them when you're adopting them, you need to continually update them and continually follow the science with respect to whether or not the tests that you have selected actually do tests for essential functions of the job. Next up, from California, we have a development in that pepper spray incident that came out of the University of California, Davis. Remember this, you've probably all seen the videos from it, a number of college students and others who were protesting, and a group of police officers used pepper spray on the protesters, if I remember right, all of whom or most of whom were seated and seemingly in a passive stance. There's been a lot of different pieces of litigation that have come out of that incident, as you might imagine. The incident only happened in November 2011. It seems like it's much longer ago than that. The most recent case, this one came out in August of 2013, comes to us courtesy of the California Court of Appeals, and it's whether or not the names of the officers involved in the incident can be redacted or need to be redacted before investigatory reports related to the incident are made public. This is a dispute that involves two newspapers that asked for unredacted copies of investigatory reports. These were investigatory reports. One set of them, they were focused on the policy issues attendant to the use of pepper spray and the handling of depositions. The other were more classic kind of IA type investigatory reports. So the reports fell in two categories. The newspapers wanted all of the reports unredacted. The Officers Union, which is the Federated University Police Officers Association, protested and said you can release the reports, but you've got to redact the names. And in particular, the union and the court focused on whether or not these reports were personnel records that were exempt from disclosure under California's equivalent of a Freedom of Information Act. And the way the California law, and it's very similar to many of these laws, defines personnel records means records that are maintained under an employee's name by his or her employer that contain personal data and employment history, including disciplinary documentation. The Court of Appeals said the officers' names are not personnel records. Instead, what the court held, and I'm quoting here, is it is clear that the names of officers interviewed or involved in the pepper spray incident are not personal data protected from disclosure. Indeed, police officers release their names to the public every day when they put on their uniforms, which are required to have a name tag unless they're working undercover. They routinely identify themselves when they go about their official duties. They sign tickets and citations in their name. They write police reports that has their name on it. They state their names when they testify in court. And in this case, it's even worse, the court says. The officers' identities were witnessed by hundreds of people and memorialized and widely distributed in photographs and videotape taken by members of the public. This, the court says, these names, this is not the stuff of which personal data that is shielded from disclosure is made. Now, this case is a little bit of a reminder that if it is the desire of management or labor to have investigatory records or investigatory information or even personnel information that is shielded from disclosure, make sure your public records law is very specifically written. I'll give you an example. In many, many states, there's nothing in a Public Records Act that shields from disclosure photographs of public safety employees. And there are some cases that hold that because a, for example, police officer's face is open to the public, you see the officer's face when the officer is on duty, unless the officer is in an undercover role, that those photographs are not protected from disclosure. That may surprise people to know that. But what I think it means, or what I think it suggests to all of us, is that it's really wise to reread your Public Records Act and make sure it's got all of the exemptions from disclosure that you really want. Let's turn to bargaining issues and a significant decision that comes to us out of the Florida Court of Appeals. And this one involves the city of Miami and its collective bargaining agreement with Lodge 20 of the Fraternal Order of Police. Under Florida law, and a few other states, not many, an employer is actually allowed to modify a collective bargaining agreement if it faces, and I'm quoting here, a financial urgency. There's a process that's set in place. The chief executive officer of the employer has to notify the union of the desire to meet and confer on the issue. But in the end, Florida law gives to employers the right to unilaterally implement their last best offer at the conclusion of the bargaining process. And that means, in the context of this financial urgency statute, that an employer can actually change the terms and conditions of a collective bargaining agreement. And so it was in Miami. While negotiations for a successor agreement were pending, the city declared a financial urgency and adopted, at the end of a very abbreviated meet and confer process, adopted wide-ranging changes and cuts in the collective bargaining agreement with the FOP. The changes included reduction in wages, elimination of education pay supplements, the end of other forms of supplemental pay, a freeze in step raises, a freeze in longevity pay, modification of the normal retirement date, modification of a pension benefit formula, etc., etc., etc. Huge changes in wages and benefits that resulted. To be sure, the city was facing significant financial challenges. The city's general fund budget in 2010 was about $500 million. It faced a deficit of $140 million. So it faced a deficit of more than 33% of its general fund budget. The city had already taken a number of steps. It had implemented hiring freezes, had conducted all sorts of layoffs. It had ceased procurement. It had instituted the elimination of jobs. And it took a wide variety of other different measures, including cutting back on all sorts of capital expenditures and the like, and it still faced this significant budget problem. The city's unemployment rate was 13.5%. At the time this happened, property values were in decline, and 49% of homes in the city of Miami had negative equity. The FOP challenged the city's actions, and the FOP's position was, look, we understand the city is facing difficult financial times, but not to the level that allowed the city to modify the collective bargaining agreement. The FOP pointed to a variety of other measures the city could have taken, including imposing non-union employee layoffs and furloughs, changing pension funding methodology, raising the mill rate on taxes, installing red light cameras, and a few other things. The FOP's argument was basically, look, not only aren't you there in terms of having the requisite financial urgency, there are also other things that you could do. Florida Court of Appeals sided with the city and allowed the contract modification to go into place. In particular, with respect to the FOP's arguments, the court said that under the financial urgency statute, A local government is not required to demonstrate that funds are not available from any other possible source to preserve a collective bargaining agreement. Instead, the test is, the court said, the governmental body must show that other potential cost-saving measures and funding sources are unreasonable or inadequate to address the dire financial condition facing the local government. In this case, the court says, look, the city was in fact facing a financial urgency. This is an urgency that required immediate attention and demanded prompt and decisive action, even if it didn't amount to the city teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. You don't have to be at the edge of bankruptcy to invoke your rights under this Florida financial urgency statute. Interesting decision, the first major decision from a court in Florida on the meaning of what a financial urgency is. Wouldn't surprise me at all to see this case end up in the Florida Supreme Court. What's going on with bargaining around the country? We are continuing to see a variety of raises from around the country that I've been saying this for several months now. We're looking at raises in about the 2% level when you look at total compensation, and we're continuing to see those from a variety of different sources. Some bigger, some smaller, but on the average, we're looking at about a 2% raise and trending a little bit upwards. So some examples from Elgin, Illinois. We have the fire department that went to binding arbitration on a contract, a two-year contract for 2012 and 2013. The 2012 raise, the arbitrator says 2%, 2013, 2.5%. The price that the firefighters had to pay is the city will be allowed to have a two-tiered system for health and life insurance with those hired after July 1, 2012, paying higher co-payments. Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office, very, very large employer, thousands of sworn deputies in Los Angeles County. Deputies there negotiated their first raise in 5 years. This is a raise that will cover the period between July 2013 and January 2015, so about an 18-month period of time. There will be three raises, 2% each, in that 18-month period of time. Baltimore, Maryland Fire Department, once again, a very long-standing, difficult negotiations, and they're going to have sort of a fascinating combination of a settlement. The wages for July 1, 2013, 2%. January 1, 2014, hold on to your hats, a 14.5% raise. However, firefighters' average work week will increase from 42 to 47.5 hours, and that's greater than a 10% increase in the average work week. The contract will also call for a 1% increase in firefighters' contribution to their pension fund, and there's a guarantee of no new layoffs. When you put all that together and you do all the math on that, it looks like about a cost of living raise. When you balance off the 14.5% against the hours, the additional hours worked and the pension contribution, it looks like about a cost of living raise, about a 2% raise. And there are many other smaller settlements that are out there. Billings, Montana, a two-year contract, 2.9%. Cranston, Rhode Island Fire Department, a city that's facing a very, very difficult financial time. The firefighters there, three-year wage freeze, including firefighters giving back a 1% increase under their old contract. And then Hemet, California Police Department, from 2013 to 2016, 4% raises each year. However, each year, the officer's pension contribution will go up about 1%. Bottom line, we're still seeing this trend around 2% for total compensation. better in some places, worse in other places, but on the average, looks like about 2%. I want to move now to an interesting Garrity versus New Jersey question. This one came into our webpage, the question and answer section of our webpage. And it poses a question I actually haven't seen asked before. The question is this. Our agency is covered by a collective bargaining agreement, and several of our members work for a county task force that is administered through the sheriff's office. So I'm assuming this is a city police department. The sheriff's office doesn't have collective bargaining. Can our members be compelled by either the sheriff's department or the city police department administration to be questioned in an IA investigation stemming from an incident that happens on a task force? And the problem is that the police labor contract allows officers to have a union rep or an attorney present, but the sheriff over in the sheriff's office, where they have this task force and there is no union, doesn't allow either a union rep or an attorney in internal affairs situations. And the question is this right? What happens in this circumstance? Do our members have the right to, this I believe is coming from the union side, do our members have the right to union representation when the sheriff's office is conducting a internal affairs investigation and the target or a witness in the internal affairs investigation is a city police officer who's covered by the collective bargaining agreement? And my answer, I hate to use the phrase lawyer weasel words, perhaps because I'm being repetitive, my answer is a little bit cagey. My answer is get this addressed in advance. The members who work for the task force should request an answer from their employer, the city, not the task force, to a basic question. Are we required as a condition of employment to comply with requests for internal affairs interviews conducted either by the county or the task force? If the city answers that question yes, then the members have to comply with the interview requests. It's a condition of employment, but will be considered to be doing so at the direction of their employer. And that means all the protections of the Garrity rule and the collective bargaining agreement and the right to representation under the Weingarten rule would apply to the interviews, as would, and you know, any protections that might exist elsewhere. If the answer to the question is no, so if the city police department looks at its officers and says, you don't have to comply with these requests for interviews in the county's internal affairs process, then members aren't required to participate in those investigations. And that means that if they do participate, they participate without the right to union representation, and they participate on a voluntary basis. And that means their statements wouldn't be protected by the Garrity rule. The easiest way to deal with this situation, though, is deal with it in advance. Ask the questions up front. If I were advising a labor organization, I'd suggest asking the questions in writing. Send an email to the employer. What's the status of the employees? Far better to resolve this question in advance than to pick up the pieces afterwards. Let's move over now to a fascinating case in Minnesota, one that I just can't believe that we will look up 2 or 3 years from now and see is good law. You'll see why in just a moment. This is a case involving a sergeant, Todd Schwanke, for the Steele County, Minnesota Sheriff's Office. He received a performance evaluation in February 2012. There were 23 different categories. Schwanke was rated as below standards in 7 of the categories, and he disagreed with that performance evaluation. And he submitted a challenge to the performance evaluation. Well, the collective bargaining agreement doesn't make performance evaluations grievable. How can Schwanke challenge the performance evaluation? And in most places, you'd say he can't. That's it. He might be able to write a rebuttal to it, but there's no system of challenging performance evaluations. Enter Minnesota's Government Data Practices Act. And Minnesota's not alone in having this statute. You need to check and see whether or not you have one of these. This is an act that allows an individual who is the, and I'm quoting, subject of government data to contest the accuracy or completeness of the data. And the idea, I think the intent here initially, was that it would be one of us, not somebody in an employment situation, but I might want to challenge, for example, my property tax records, or might want to challenge some other piece of information that the city of Portland, Oregon is maintaining on me. I think that's what the design of the act was. But the act's pretty broadly written, and it allows any individual who's the subject of government data to contest the accuracy or completeness of the data. Not only does it give them the right to contest it, if the individual is dissatisfied with the governmental body's answer to the challenge, then the individual can appeal to an administrative law judge with the Minnesota Department of Administration and get a full-fledged hearing. Schwanke invoked the Government Data Practices Act in his challenge to the performance evaluation. The Department of Administration, which is supposed to conduct these hearings, said the equivalent of, come on, this isn't what this statute was meant for. And Schwanke took it up with the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and the court sided with Schwanke. The court said that data on individuals is defined as all government data in which the individual is or can be identified as the subject of the data. And in this case, the court said it's pretty simple. Steele County is a governmental entity. Personnel data is maintained because an individual is employee of the governmental entity, and that is government data on individuals. An employee evaluation is data created and maintained by a government entity. Therefore, the Department of Administration should not have dismissed Schwanke's request for a hearing. It instead should consider the request for a hearing, should assign a hearings officer, and is required to do a case-by-case analysis as to whether or not this is the sort of government data that is the subject of the act. There's a couple of things that can happen here, three things actually that can happen here as to why I'm saying this may not be good law 2 years from now. First thing that can happen is, of course, the Department of Administration or Steele County conceivably could appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court, might reverse the opinion. I'm not thinking that's going to happen. That seems like a kind of a off chance. Second thing that can happen is the Department of Administration could engage in what you could nicely call malicious compliance, and that is that it could grant Schwanke his right to a hearing. It's got to do so. And then very quickly in the hearing say, look, a performance evaluation isn't in fact data. What it is subjective assessments made by supervisors, and that's not data. And then we probably see Schwanke appeal back up to the Court of Appeals. The third thing, what I think is the most likely here, is that you will see a coalition of both employers and unions going to the Minnesota legislature saying, really, we don't really want to be setting up a hearing system that's going to cost thousands of dollars each time to consider appeals of performance evaluations. Unions will likely be concerned as to whether or not that's an extension of their duty of fair representation. And employers and the Department of Administration will be concerned, if only because of the cost of that sort of hearing system. I think that's probably the most likely scenario that will happen here. But in the meantime, fascinating case and a watchword to all of you. If you have this sort of statute, you know, we don't normally pay attention to in labor circles. If you have this sort of statute, think about whether it might well apply to all different forms of employee data. Okay, now we've got three cases from New York. The New York courts have been very busy, and the three cases are, they deal with different subjects, but they're pretty fascinating cases. The first one isn't a public safety case per se, but it has a lot of public safety implications. It's a GPS case. This is a case involving a fellow named Michael Cunningham. who was the director of staff and organizational development for the New York Department of Labor. And the state began to suspect that Cunningham was shirking his duties, that he was going off on a lark during the course of the day and falsifying records to conceal his absences from work. The state conducted a fairly lengthy investigation, and the investigation involved attaching a GPS tracking device to Cunningham's car. Eventually, the Department of Labor fired Cunningham, basing its decision in part on the GPS information. And Cunningham appealed to New York's highest court, the New York Court of Appeals. And the court had to answer two questions. The court said, look, you know, this is potentially a Fourth Amendment issue, assigning a GPS tracking device. It's a Fourth Amendment issue. So we have to decide, first of all, is a warrant required? And secondly, without regard to whether a warrant is required, is this search, the placement of the GPS tracking device is a search, is this search reasonable? Because, of course, under the Fourth Amendment, searches and seizures have to be reasonable. The first question, with respect to the warrant, the court said, don't need a warrant to attach a GPS device. This is like, the court said, a desk search or a locker search. It falls within the workplace exception to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement. The court said, look, this is pretty much a common sense issue. This is, Cunningham is driving a car during his normal work hours. The location of his car, even if it's his own personal car, in the words of the court, doesn't seem to us to be more private than what's on an employee's desk. Cunningham was required to report his arrival and departure times. That diminished any expectation of privacy that he might have in the location of the car. So we don't think that a warrant is required to put a GPS tracking device on a car. But what about the second question? Was the use of the tracking device reasonable? And the court said no. The use of the GPS device was excessively intrusive. It examined, you know, borrowing from the court's opinion here, much activity with which the state had no business. For example, tracked Cunningham's activities when he was on vacation, when he was on his days off. The employer has no business obtaining that sort of information. It could have taken the device off. It could have turned the device off, but it did not do those things. And the court's bottom line, where an employer conducts a GPS search without making a reasonable effort to avoid tracking an employee outside of business hours, the search as a whole must be considered unreasonable, and that conclusion requires the suppression of the GPS evidence. The court sent the case back down to the lower court to determine whether there was enough untainted evidence to substantiate the decision to terminate Cunningham. Not in this case, by the way, is any discussion of the bargaining implications of putting a GPS tracking device on an employee's car. That's probably because Cunningham was a non-union employee. That remains an open question, whether or not employers can use those sorts of investigatory tools in an internal affairs investigation without bargaining over the use of the new tools. I tend to think the answer is going to be employers are going to have to bargain over that sort of stuff, but we just haven't seen enough in the way of case law on it. Second case up from New York is an unusual case involving residency requirements. New York has a state statute, been around for a long time, that requires deputy sheriffs to live in the county which employs them. But the statute doesn't make city police officers live either in the city where they work or in the county where that city is. This is a lawsuit from a deputy sheriff for the Monroe County Sheriff's Office in New York who said that distinction is unconstitutional. You can't treat city police officers better for residency purposes than you treat county deputies. and a federal court in New York dismissed the deputy's lawsuit. The court said, look, there's a different function from a sheriff and a city police department. Deputy sheriffs act as the personal agent of the sheriff in the performance of various civil duties. And because of that, they're thought to have broader duties and broader responsibilities, and there is some rational basis, and rational basis means any basis, some rational basis for this distinction in the law, and therefore New York can require county deputies to be residents and not require city police officers to be residents. The last case out of New York is a case that just made my head sort of spin around, you know, like Reagan in The Exorcist, the little girl in The Exorcist, how her head spins around. I found this one kind of shocking coming from New York. And the reason it shocked me so much is in New York, you don't see the normal disciplinary appeals you do in other states where discipline is appealed to arbitration. Instead, there's usually a very involved internal appeal process for discipline. And eventually courts the disciplinary appeals make their way into court. And the courts have a standard for the review of discipline that pretty much guarantees employees can never win. I can say, and I say this very conservatively, I've read hundreds and hundreds of cases in New York where courts have upheld the discipline of public safety employees. I've read probably less than five cases where the courts have ever overturned discipline. And what's so tough about that standard? The standard is that the punishment has to be so disproportionate to the offense as to shock one's sense of fairness. And courts just don't get shocked very often. And so it was when I read the story of Carlton Peterson, a police officer for the city of Poughkeepsie, New York, that I ended up getting shocked. Peterson was fired for drinking on the job and for an act of dishonesty related to the drinking, for submitting a false time card regarding his activities during his lunch break. This all happened on Christmas Eve, 2009. Peterson was working a shift from 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., and he was observed at an establishment known as Andy's Place, consuming a beer and a shot of liquor from 1:40 p.m. to 2:40 p.m., so smack dab in the middle of his shift, and then he returned to work. The court overturned his termination. The court said this one-hour time frame has cost Peterson his job and his benefits associated with the position. There is simply no evidence before this court that Peterson, during his 19 years of employment, had presented a disciplinary problem or that the incident was anything but isolated. The penalty of termination is so disproportionate to the offense as to be shocking to one's sense of fairness. And the court sent the case back to the city to consider the imposition of a lesser penalty. And the reason I'm so surprised by this is, would this be a termination offense in a binding arbitration state? Maybe. Maybe. Even first offense, 19 years on the job, drinking on duty, and then falsifying a time card associated with the drinking on duty, and then going back to work after you've consumed alcohol, would that be a firing offense? I think in a lot of places that would be. Are there a lot of cases in New York where firefighters, corrections officers, and police officers have done a lot less serious things than drinking on the job and had their terminations upheld? You bet. This may be the right combination of three judges on this case to decide that Peterson should be given a break. It's just a kind of a very unusual decision. Don't think it sets a trend for the notion that drinking on the job and then lying about it and coming back to work and continuing to drive around a patrol car is not a termination offense. The next case that's interesting that came down over the last month, I think is important to us more as a reminder than anything else. Often when we're bargaining a labor contract, we don't pay attention to the specific language in the grievance procedure as much as we should. And you end up occasionally getting caught, 4 or 5 years after you put some language in the contract, 20 years after the language has been put in the contract, someone will raise a point about what this section of the grievance procedure means. Nobody's ever talked about it at the table. Nobody's ever thought about it. And you end up with an arbitration decision or a court decision that is surprising to one of the parties because it's an issue that's never been brought up at the table. It's really important, I think, that every time we sit down at the table, we very carefully read the grievance procedure in the contract to make sure that it says what we want it to say. And here's the facts of this case that I think illustrate that point. This is a case involving the city of Naperville in Illinois and a police officer named William Kovarik in Naperville. The city's Department of Public Works is responsible for snow removal from city streets, and each snow season, the Department of Public Works will hire employees from other city departments to drive snow plows and remove snow. It's a voluntary program available to employees. It's controlled and managed not by the police department, but by the Department of Public Works. And the police department doesn't have any role in hiring, firing, or managing snow plow drivers. In 2009, Kovarik applied with the Department of Public Works to be a snow plow driver, and he wasn't hired. He filed a grievance under the contract between the city and the FOP, claiming that he had a contractual right to the snow plow work and was wrongfully denied that opportunity. An arbitrator looked at the contract and said, yeah, this is a past practice, granted the grievance, and the city then challenged the arbitrator's opinion in court on the grounds that the grievance was not, the grievance and the arbitration, they were not subject to arbitration under the grievance procedure. The Illinois Court of Appeals agreed with the city. The court said here, the party's contract indicates that only a grievance that involved an express provision of the contract would be subject to arbitration. Express means something that is clearly and unmistakably communicated. Since there's no provision in the collective bargaining agreement that says that a police officer may seek to arbitrate the city's failure to hire him as a snowplow driver while he's off duty, that means that Kovarik's grievance is not subject to arbitration. Now, is the court's decision wrong here? Well, sure, it's wrong. An arbitrator, even under Illinois law, and there's plenty of cases that say this, an arbitrator has the power to interpret and apply the collective bargaining agreement, including implied provisions in a collective bargaining agreement, such as a notion of maintenance of standards. You can go back to the Steelworkers trilogy of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1960s and find that arbitrators not only have that power, that's really one of the things arbitrators are supposed to do. So I think the court's decision here is wrong. I don't think it's wrong to the point where the Illinois Supreme Court will hear the case and overturn it. But without regard to whether the court's opinion is right or wrong, could this have been addressed through different language in the grievance procedure? Sure. Take a look at that language that says express provision and modify it. If you're the union and you want to challenge these sorts of things, that's another question, by the way. If you're a union, would you really want to challenge whether or not police officers are entitled to do snowplow work? I don't know. But if you're a union and you do want to get into that business, make sure your grievance procedure is broad enough to allow you to get in that business. Okay, let's change gears entirely, move to a tragic case that came out of New Mexico. And it's a case that illustrates, I think, a very broad principle that has roots all over the country as to workers' compensation rights and special rules that apply to primarily police officers, but also firefighters, but primarily to police officers. This is a case involving Kevin Schultz, who was a police officer with the Pueblo of, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Pojac Tribal Police Department in New Mexico. Pueblo is the equivalent of a city in New Mexico. And one day, Officer Schultz was off duty and voluntarily chaperoning a church youth group in a recreational area on the Rio Grande River. Officer Schultz wasn't in the Pueblo's limits. He was not on call that day. He wasn't in uniform. He was carrying his badge and had his pager and firearm, but that was it in terms of relationship to the job. While Officer Schultz was there at this function, a youth group function, a child was drowning. Officer Schultz jumped in the river, rescued the child, and in the process, he himself drowned. Officer Schultz's sacrifice was honored at national and local levels. He was recognized at the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, as well as the New Mexico equivalent of that. His wife and their son were awarded survivor benefits under the Public Safety Officers Benefits Act. And the lieutenant governor of the Pueblo, that's kind of like an assistant mayor, sent a letter to Officer Schultz's wife recognizing that her husband died in the line of duty and said that the Pueblo would do anything necessary for her to receive survivor's benefits, including workers' compensation. All of that was lost on the Pueblo's workers' compensation carrier that denied his wife's or his widow's request for survivor benefits. And the workers' compensation carrier took the position that Schultz did not die in the line of duty. The New Mexico Court of Appeals sided with Schultz's widow. And here's what the court has to say. This is why I wanted to talk about this case a little bit and this notion that workers' compensation laws are a little bit different for police officers in particular. The court says a distinctive body of workers' comp law has arisen surrounding injuries to off-duty police officers. This is because officers fulfill a unique role in society that coincides with increased responsibilities and a greater sense of duty to their employment than the average citizen. That could be said, by the way, of other public safety employees, but these cases usually are police cases. This sense of duty can arise both from official dictates of police officer conduct or from societal expectations that we give to police officers and the fact that we rely on them. The court is saying that we think a police officer's eligibility for injuries sustained in circumstances outside of the normal line of employment, when we have those sorts of cases, we need to look at the circumstances giving rise to the accident, and specifically the nature of the officer's actions and the manner of their performance in related to a similarly situated on-duty officer. Of course, saying this doesn't mean that, you know, all off-duty injuries are necessarily compensable under workers' compensation. But the court's saying, look, the simple fact that somebody is off duty is of, and here's what the court's words, little analytic value insofar as determining whether or not the injuries are compensable. What about Schultz? The court says there was a sufficient nexus between the incident, the rescue, and Officer Schultz's duties as a public safety officer to support an award of compensation. The extent of a police officer's duty to protect and serve the public is not limited to crime protection, and rendering assistance to a child in danger of drowning is among those risks to which common sense dictates that an on-duty officer faced with a similar circumstance would be expected to respond. The court also found it important that the employer's rules didn't prohibit Schultz from taking action in that sort of situation. Of course, no police department's rules probably would say that. And The court concludes by saying there may be some circumstances where a response to an emergency off duty would be so incongruent with the expected response of a similarly situated on-duty officer to remove the officer's actions from the course of employment. But this isn't that case. We are going to give a broad reading to an officer's duties while off duty, and what might not be a compensable injury for some other type of employee will be for a police officer. Got one last case I want to talk about, just in general terms. I don't want to spend too much time on this. It's a case that comes out of the always entertaining Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the federal appeals court that has jurisdiction over Western states. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is the largest of the federal courts of appeals in terms of having the most judges. And perhaps because it's the largest, it's the most unpredictable. You can draw a three-judge panel on the Ninth Circuit that will rule precisely to the opposite of what another random draw from the Ninth Circuit panel would be. In fact, there used to be a phenomenon in the Ninth Circuit. You would show up for oral argument in cases before the Ninth Circuit. You wouldn't know who your panel members were until you got to court that morning. And then you'd look and you'd see the three names of the judges who were going to decide your case. And you'd realize, because of the polarized ideology of many of these judges, you'd realize right then whether you won or lost your case. It used to be called Monday morning jaw drop at the Ninth Circuit. That's what that phrase was. Well, this is a case that deals with the Garcetti rule. This is the Supreme Court decision that so radically changed the way we view free speech rights of public employees in this country. The Garcetti rule says that if speech is made pursuant to the job, it's not protected by the First Amendment, and an employer can discipline the employee for the speech. And it may well be that the speech is protected under a state whistleblowing statute. Many states, not all, have whistleblowing statutes. It may be that the speech is protected through a disciplinary appeals process, like binding arbitration. But it's not protected by the First Amendment, says the Supreme Court. This is not a place where courts have any business. And there have been all sorts of federal court decisions, hundreds and hundreds of them, after Garcetti and the whatever it's been, 6-7 years after Garcetti, that have held that speech that we think of as being protected under the First Amendment, we used to think of as being protected by the First Amendment, is not protected anymore. So speech, for example, reporting a fellow employee who committed a crime has been held not to be protected because that's within the job responsibilities of a public employee. And therefore, because it's within the job responsibilities, it's not protected. Testifying truthfully in internal affairs has been held to be unprotected by the First Amendment because, of course, it's your job to testify truthfully in internal affairs, and therefore it's part of your job. And under Garcetti, it's not protected. It's a rule that I think is stunningly bereft of rationality, but nonetheless, as one Supreme Court justice once said about the Supreme Court, we are not final because we're right. We're right because we're final. And for now, that 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court has said this sort of speech is unprotected. So what's the Ninth Circuit doing in August of 2013? Well, this is a case that is, from the court's recitation of the facts, quite a saga. And we don't know at this point whether or not these facts are accurate, whether or not this is what's going to be proven at trial. We just know what the claims are. And the question is whether or not those claims amount to a First Amendment violation. And here's what the claims are. This is a case that involves Angelo Dahlia, who's an officer with the Burbank, California Police Department. In 2007, there was an armed robbery at Porto's Bakery and Cafe in Burbank, and Dahlia was assisted in the robbery investigation, which was supervised by a lieutenant named John Murphy. The day after the robbery, Dahlia said that he saw another lieutenant, a Lieutenant Rodriguez, grab a suspect by the throat with his left hand, retrieve his handgun from its holster with his right hand and place the barrel under the suspect's eyes, saying, "How does it feel to have a gun in your face, motherfucker?" Later that evening, Dahlia heard yelling and the sound of someone being hit and slapped from inside a room where a sergeant was interviewing a suspect. Dahlia was subsequently excluded, he says, from participating in suspect interviews, and high-ranking officers within the department took control of the investigation. Dahlia says that witnesses and suspects were physically assaulted and beaten in the interview rooms, and officers prevented anyone from walking by the rooms. Dahlia met with his lieutenant, Murphy, to disclose the abuse that he'd witnessed and told him that the interviews were getting too physical and that the beatings were happening. And Murphy, according to Dahlia, said, "Stop your sniveling." The physical beatings continued in interview rooms. There's apparently booking photos of suspects that attest to the fact that physical force was used. And at one point, Dahlia says, the police chief appeared at a briefing and on learning that not all the robbery suspects were in custody said, "Well, then beat another one until they're all in custody." Dahlia approached Murphy a second time and told Murphy, "Look, you don't have control over this case." And Dahlia said that Murphy became upset, told Dahlia didn't want to hear this shit again, and that he was tired of all the BS. Dahlia and another detective met with Murphy a third time, telling him the beatings have to stop and the madness has to stop. Murphy, according to Dahlia, did nothing to respond to the complaints, and the tactics continued. Eventually, Dahlia complies with cooperates with an investigation into all this done by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and tells them what he saw and disclosed the statements that were made to him as well as statements he heard from others. 4 days later, the city placed him on administrative leave pending discipline. Dahlia also complained about what had been happening to his union, the Burbank Police Officers Association, who in turn reported it to the city manager. All of this was punctuated by what Dahlia says were additional threats. So Dahlia describes one incident, there's many, I'll just give you one, where Rodriguez, this is the other lieutenant, called Dahlia into his office, told him to sit down, closed the door and blinds, retrieved his gun from his holster, looked at Dahlia, and put the gun in a drawer, and at one point during the meeting, placed his hands on the desk and told Dahlia, "I am not a fucking cheese-eating rat," and then said he wasn't afraid of being suspended or being fired. And Rodriguez apparently also told Dahlia, "Fuck with me and I'll put a case on you. I'll put you in jail. I put all kinds of people in jail, especially anyone who fucks with me." Dahlia eventually sued the city, saying that the placement on administrative leave pending discipline was an adverse employment action, and it was in retaliation for his engaging in free speech. And what's the free speech? Cooperating with the Sheriff's Department investigation, making complaints about the various actions and statements that he heard, and also reporting to his union president what had happened. A 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit ruled that under the Garcetti rule, Dahlia lost because these are the sorts of things we would expect police officers to do as part of their jobs, to make these sorts of complaints. And that Dahlia, when making the complaints and testifying in front of the sheriff's office investigation, that those were all elements of his job, and hence, under the Garcetti rule, the First Amendment gave Dahlia no protections. Might have protections elsewhere, but not under the First Amendment, said this 3-judge panel. Parenthetically, I will tell you that seems to be the way most courts have gone with respect to these types of cases. What the panel's decision here was not at all unusual. Dahlia's lawyers then file a motion for what's called an en banc hearing before the Ninth Circuit. En banc means The whole court sits in the Ninth Circuit. That's not quite possible because there's so many judges, but it means a much larger panel than the normal panel of three judges. And the en banc panel that ended up rehearing the case included the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, a very, very politically conservative and very bright judge, very politically conservative judge, particularly on labor issues. And to, I think, a lot of people's surprise, the en banc panel reversed the three court judges' decision and held that it was indeed possible that Dahlia's comments, his compliance with the sheriff's office investigation, his complaints through the chain of command, his complaints to the union, it was indeed possible that they were constitutionally protected. The court said, look, you have to do more than just look at a job description for a police officer. In the words of the court, formal job descriptions often bear little resemblance to the duties an employee actually is expected to perform, and the listing of a given task in an employee's written job description is neither necessary nor sufficient to demonstrate that conducting the task is within the course of the employee's professional duties for First Amendment purposes. Relevant factors the lower court's going to have to consider here in deciding this, include whether or not the employee communicated concerns outside of the chain of command, Dahlia did here, whether the speech is contained in a routine report, these weren't routine reports Dahlia was making, and whether the speech contravenes the specific orders from the employee's supervisors, Dahlia's speech did, his supervisors, he alleges, told him to be quiet. So what the court is saying is, lower court, you've got to consider all of these factors, but really what the Ninth Circuit is saying is Dahlia's speech should be considered to be constitutionally protected. This is a crack in the armor of Garcetti. And this is one, you know, it's very difficult to decide whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear a case. You know, the Supreme Court is asked to hear thousands of cases a year. It typically hears far less than 100 a year. So it's not very good odds that a case will be decided by the Supreme Court. But this is one where you look at it and you think, maybe. And maybe for a lot of reasons. First of all, reversing the Ninth Circuit is almost a recreational activity for the five-judge majority we have on the U.S. Supreme Court. The Ninth Circuit, for many, many years, was the most frequently reversed court by the Supreme Court of any court in the country. Now appears to be the Sixth Circuit. It seems that shifted a little bit, but the Ninth Circuit is still way, way out there. Secondly, you have this decision being really almost a rejection of part of the Garcetti Doctrine. This is a lower court pretty much telling the Supreme Court, you got it wrong. And that tends to interest the Supreme Court. So you may well see the Supreme Court looking at this Dahlia case. It's more likely than most other cases, almost any other case I've seen this year, that I've looked at a case and thought, well, maybe the Supreme Court's going to have another chance to take a look at the Garcetti Doctrine. That's it for this month. We hope to see you in October for First Thursday. I predict it's going to be a very, very busy September. That summer vacation that a lot of courts went into will be over. I think we're going to see a bunch of new opinions coming out over the course of September. So look forward to seeing you on the first Thursday in October. Thanks.